Erlen Sports.
Hello and welcome to the Verulam Sport Podcast. Every week, the team behind the award-winning Radio Verulam Sports Show will provide you with the most relevant news from the local and regional sporting scenes, whilst keeping you in the picture with national and international bulletins from the world of sport. There will be topical debates, regular interviews from local talent, and chats with those big-name guests that are a mainstay of Verulam Sport. As always, this is your show, every bit as much as it is ours. So, check out Verulam Sport across social media and get involved. For now, prepare yourself for this week's action-packed Verulam Sport Podcast. Hello and welcome again to another action-packed Verulam Sport Podcast, the highlight of my personal week, and I know it's yours too, listening there. And I tell you what, as always, we've got an action-packed debate to consider, to dissect, to analyse for you. And as always, it's thanks to you, our wonderful listeners, that this is our topic of debate for this week. And we are going to be breaking down the all-time greatest sporting dynasties. Those teams or individuals who, for a sustained period, not a blip, not an aberration, but for a sustained period, were the force in any given sport. It's going to be fascinating to get into this one. And as always, I know you've been super busy across social media, as it is, of course, your show, every bit as much as it is ours. Keep involved after today. Keep your sporting dynasties coming. There's so many. They're rich and they're varied. And just keep involved. Anything sports related, you sportsman folk, you get involved. Love hearing your views. And I know they've been busy as always this week, keeping our man, the machine, Jason McKenna, incredibly busy in this sweltering heat. Goodness me. Jason, what has the world of social media been saying about sporting dynasties?
Hi, Tony. Yeah, it's been a busy week once again on the social media, and a lot of people are loving this sporting dynasties, kind of looking back at some of the greatest individuals, but also the greatest teams of all time. Richard has messaged in on a football kind of topic. He said the Brazilian team of the 50s through to the 70s were some of the best footballers of all time. Nigel has pointed out that the West Indian cricket team of the 70s was fantastic. Sarah has given a shout out to the Team GB cycling team that has hoofed and really changed the cycling kind of setup at the Olympics, but around the world as well. But we've also had Mark Spitz, Michael Phelps mentioned, Chicago Red Bulls, Red Rum from horse racing, Tiger Woods, Ballesteros, and one of your favourites there, Tony, Sir Nick Faldo, Ronnie O'Sullivan from snooker, Ali and Tyson from boxing. We've got Phil the Power Taylor, some of the greatest racing drivers as well, the Yankees, and of course, one of our local teams that we like to talk about, Saracens as well. So we've had like quite an eclectic mix. Some people have given their shout outs to all sorts of sports there, and we always welcome people to get involved.
Love that summation. Again, what I love about this chat with you guys, and it's reflected there in the wonderful thoughts of those listeners getting involved, and make sure you keep involved, just how diverse it is, isn't it? It's not just a singular entity or just one-off people, but if you just think of like on one end of the spectrum, that Brazilian team, you think of Pelé and all manner of others, Socrates, and the list goes on and on. And then at the other end, England's winningest sports person all time, who I think, disclaimer, and indeed spoiler, may well feature a little bit more in depth in this one. I'm talking Phil the Power Taylor. I mean, you're diverging, your world's apart, but that's why we love sports. It's so fascinating, so compelling, and I'm looking forward to getting into this. Sporting dynasties, teams and or individuals who transcended their time, their moment, and actually went on for a period of time of sustained dominance. A man who oozes dominance, but in a gentlemanly fashion. I'm now delighted to go across to the voice of the Saints, the ever erudite Graham Griffin, to introduce to us tonight his first choice of all-time classic sporting dynasty. What you got for us, Graham?
Thank you, Tony, and good evening, team. So, yes, my first pick of the night is going to be an organisation, a football club, which involves a few individuals, so a bit of a mix of individuals and organisation to be a dynasty. And I've gone with, of course, Manchester United Football Club. So I've chosen Manchester United Football Club for a couple of reasons. But the first is just to say, through its journey, it seems to the response of people that have been connected to the club has always been quite positive. And there's always been this, in particular for players and coaches, this desire to want to be involved, be it from a ambassador point of view or a coaching point of view. And obviously we see that at the moment with the club from an ex-player in Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. So two key people within that. Obviously the club was formed 1876, known as Newton Heath, as we saw that sort of breakaway formation many years ago, which they set up, and they took their original colours of green and yellow. And then the original Manchester United was potentially formed in 1902. So that's 118 years worth of history, if not an extra 20 odd years on top of that with the Newton Heath situation. But if we go back to the Busby Babes and that horrific air traffic accident, what was really interesting there is right up to the Fergie days, there was that sort of connection of culture and connection of what are they really trying to achieve, a sense of purpose and, you know, play the game to its optimum, really. And even between Sir Matt Busby and Sir Alex Ferguson, there were still some really good coaches. Not as good as obviously them two, but they were still really, really good. So they were always striving to be the best. And I really like that desire to just be your best and keep driving, because it takes time to get to become something. And what was interesting there is obviously their logo, their colours, their connection to the city, their capacity of the stadium. It just seems to be growing and growing to this day where it's potentially worth £4 billion from a sort of revenue perspective. But then it's, if we go back to...
It's definitely one of the most recognisable brands in all of the world. You go to anywhere on the planet and they will know that kind of Red Devil, won't they? They recognize it. It oozes that. And they've definitely kind of trailblazed in that regard. Great shout. And anyway, you were going to go on to elaborate, so continue.
Yeah, and just one or two more things on that is that if we look at the Fergie era, 38 trophies he won. 38 trophies? Okay, it was over 25, 26-year period, but that's still impressive. 13 Premier Leagues, 5 FA Cups, 2 UEFA Champions League, and then all the Community Shields and World Championships in and around that. He's very, very impressive. And I just, you know, if you look at the characteristics of Sir Matt Busby and Sir Alex Ferguson, that desire, that sort of coming from that background of hunger, you know, wanting to self-actualize and aspire. And even to this day, you know, the influence that them individuals have had on individuals in the club, it's just a wonderful scenario. You could argue it's a shame it's not in British hands from an ownership perspective, but the Americans, the Glazer family, have obviously done really, really well from a perspective of growing it, even in times of change after the Fergie era. So they're still growing from a revenue dynasty point of view. And for them reasons, you've got to say, as an organisation, as much as its individual players and coaches, it is just phenomenal. That's a dynasty, surely.
Yeah, no debate about that. And we were talking, weren't we, last week when we were going through, you know, the teams of, you know, and things like that nature. And we were talking about the difficulty of winning the Premier League 3 times. Fergie did it twice. And it's the only time it's only in the whole era of the Premier League, it's only been done twice. Fergie, I think, from 08 through 10. And then, obviously, before that, that great treble-winning side, which, of course, you know, included that amazing sporting theatre, as I like to say, victory over Bayern Munich, 99 through and then 2000 and 2001. The only times that's been done. Graham, I'm going to advocate the devil here, though, so to speak, using the Red Devil pun intendedly, because that's how I roll. Now, there's no question about it. You've nailed it down. I don't think there's a debate that Manchester United equals one of the all-time great sporting dynasties. I've got no questions about that. But given the domestic successes and the array of FA Cups, and obviously, again, he's done it across worlds and European levels and this and that, is it possible? And I know the Red side of Merseyside would always say, we still have bragging rights because we have more Champions Leagues than Fergie. Fergie got 2, but given the array of talent, given the dominance on that domestic scene, could you argue, not to
take away from the dynasty, not in any way, shape or form, but just to advocate the devil, that is not necessarily the best return for all of that great dominance, culture, talent that he was the man, the Don over. Just quickly, your thoughts, or am I just being a little bit churlish?
Yes. There? No, I absolutely agree with you. Me and Jason have spoke about this previous, and I would say the exact same thing. That was his potential, how can we say it? His potential disappointment to himself. I think he should have won a lot more. There was a lot of occasions where they got to quarterfinals, semifinals of Champions League or European competitions, and they just really wavered at the last. And I actually think that really bothers him, because I think he got his tactics wrong, his team selections wrong, which, you know, sounds really critical, but it's not, considering the overall package he did. But I totally agree with you, Moore. I think he lacked in that. And I think that's one big thing that psychologically has really stuck with him as a sense of failing.
But I'll tell you what, he's still a presence, isn't he? I'll tell you, honestly, I always said it was going to be a poison chalice for whoever took up the mantle. It's interesting, and you really dissected it wonderfully recently, Graham, when you analysed the upsurge in Solskjaer. Again, a young man who appreciates that culture, that brand, and all the ethos behind it. But my goodness me, you look at those array of world-class talented managers who've endeavoured to fill the boots, so to speak, and even my man Jose was found wanting in the cauldron that is the Theatre of Dreams at Old Trafford, in the shadow always of Fergie. My final thing on Sir Alex Ferguson, before we move this on, great first shout to what is going to be, I'm no doubt, a great discussion tonight. You know what? I just find this wonderful, because again, we were slightly critical there of Sir Alex Ferguson and his European accomplishments. But there was always this thing, wasn't there, about quote unquote Fergie time. Now, our man, the machine, Jason McKenna, gave us a brilliant bit of data on this, which actually said that was a little bit skewed. It was maybe more in the mind than anything else in terms of the actuality of it. But I think winners win, don't they? And both sides, if you think about it, this Fergie side time, mythical or at least legendary as it is or was, it was open to both teams, wasn't it? It's not as if the other team are then placed on pause whilst Fergie time goes on. It's still live. The game, you're told as a youngster, aren't you? You play to the whistle. And that's my point. They converted narrow defeats into draws, eking out a point. They grabbed that late, late dramatic winner. But again, the team against them could have prevented that, and indeed could have embraced the extra time, the Fergie time, to kind of spin it on its head. But they didn't, did they? They didn't, no way. Because winners win. Winners win, don't they? They find that way, that use that time, and they maximise their opportunities. I love it.
Yeah, and look at 1999. If he didn't create that mentality of you keep playing into the 96th, 97th minutes, a lot of players switch off for the last 7-8 minutes, thinking it's all going to be over. But we know you can score in seconds. He created that culture with his class of 92 right through to those added. And look at what happened in 1999 for that reason. So, yeah, I think a bit of it is a myth. Some of it is psychology with the referee as well. But I tell you what, he got his players to perform, and Ollie's doing the same now, if you notice. It's quite fascinating to see.
Absolutely. And it's there's no question, it's a dynasty apt for the name. And I would say they fit right up there. They can look anybody in the eyes across all sports, all dynasties, all time. Maybe the caveat we've discussed, perhaps slightly underachieved at the European level. But great shout, great initial conversation piece. Loving your work, Graham. And now we're going to introduce Neil to bring forth your first sporting dynasty. Who you got for us, Neil?
Right, I'm going into the world of darts, and it'll be Phil the Power Taylor. So, what can we say really about Phil Taylor? 16 world championships. This is just the stats. 16 world championships, 281 wins, tournament wins. He's just a phenomenal player. Phil Taylor, I think, is like Marmite. You either like him or you don't. I've actually met Phil Taylor, and the way he is on stage playing darts, the arrogance that he shows on stage actually is off stage as well. It's one of those things. I had to go to him to interview him. He wouldn't come to the media room. I had to go to him, wherever he was. That's the arrogance with Phil Taylor. He does what he wants and how he wants to do it, because he's got that. He had, until he retired in 2018, he had that dominance. Through the BDO, he was the founder member, if I remember correctly, of the PDC and the breakaway from the BDO. And my God, did he take that bull by the horns, as you say, and he ran with it and won those 16 world championships.
Neil, I think this is such a wonderful suggestion. It's fascinating that you've had that insight personally. Great to meet him. Never had the pleasure, but the power. Maybe one of the most apposite, appropriate nicknames, monikers in all the sports, because he was that man, that power. But I'll tell you what he did as well. Again, he allied to that breakaway moment. Again, some things collide in the perfect storm. Again, with the Hearn's genius to kind of have the PR and the Sky razzmatazz and all the analysis that they could do, and the kind of big build-up and the hype packages. And it made it from sort of a kind of sleepy backward sport, almost a glorified pub game, really, into a multinational, a global entity. And he is... Yeah. You know, I use this phrase all the time on Variable Sport Podcasting, but he is, in terms of, as the Yanks say, and as I like to use, winningest English sports star across any sport. I mean, you take football, golf, cricket, you name it, tiddlywinks, chess, who cares? Who's got bragging rights? Who's got the most in the trophy cabinets? It is the man, Phil Taylor. And I tell you what I love about him, Neil, and maybe you can elaborate on this, is that if you look at the game now, and it has gone on to another level in his sort of retirement time, as obviously things must. But if you look at the averages that he was putting in, if you compare that to when his kind of guru, if you would, the guy who kind of got him to the table, Eric Bristow, who almost shook him up and said, look, Phil, you've got talent, man. You need to make the most of it. But I guess Bristow at his best when he got his fifth, which just seems so insignificant compared to 16, doesn't it? But fifth at that time, BDO title. You know, I guess in the finals, he was capable of getting a 9-dart average of 90. He did it periodically, but it was flashes. It was periodic. I would imagine he would be averaging maybe 85 across a tournament. Now, so thanks to the single-minded dedication, Taylor, you listen to an interview, he will be on record. This is my life. This is what I do. I wake up, I play darts. I wake up, I play darts. I wake up, I play darts. I play darts all day, right? And he's got that muscle memory then. He's got it down. And that, again, it's like Gary Player once upon a time has said, it's funny, the harder I work, the luckier I get. And Taylor had that aura, but he made it. He was a product of talent and then supreme application. So, yeah, I just wonder if you could elaborate there on the now what the world of darts owes to Phil Taylor and his commitment, his sheer utter commitment to his art and his craft.
If you think, going back, Phil Taylor in the PDC, first televised 9-darter.
Yeah.
He didn't just do that once, twice, three times, four times. I think he was the first to do all of that, 4 televised, 5 televised.
Yeah.
And he also had the highest average, I think it was 118.2. For a tournament average, which is outstanding. But as the years have gone on, since I've sort of got involved and watching the darts a lot and following players, the averages have just crept up from the high 80s to mid 90s. Then you've got people pushing. You have people pushing on Phil Taylor's shoulders. You had James Wade, Gary Anderson, Adrian Lewis, Peter Wright, Michael Van Gerwen, Mensah Sulevic. They were all pushing. They're not just pushing Phil, but they're all pushing each other to go that one step or two steps better. But what they owe the darts now, owe that to Phil, because he set the bar. He's literally set the bar. And I don't think at the moment anyone's going to get close to it. No, Michael Van Gerwen's having a good old bash at it, but I don't think...
But as you say, Neil, you broke that down brilliantly. There are so many players now at such a high quality level, and just bubbling away underneath that, you've got the likes of Price, haven't you? And so many others. Again, because it is a great way to make a living. These top names will be making top dollar, and again, that's only been made possible through the paving ways, the genius that was Phil Taylor. So just, you're dead right in the brute stats, and we love a good stat here, simply doesn't lie. 16 world titles, and I think there was a run in which he went on something staggering like 8-9 in a row, which was almost mind-blowing. You know, he is the king amongst men when it comes to darts, even now. And I'll tell you again, we usually, when we hear the word sporting dynasty, we associate that with a team. Darts, of course, eminently an individual sport, but there can be no doubt about it. Great, great shout, Neil. Loving the shout of Phil Taylor. I think he's worthy of any place in any sporting dynasty all time.
If you look at it, you've got the other side of the coin, the BDO players that are now following and moving over the likes of Glenn Durant, and you've had a few others come across. Fallon
Sharon Pollock, is she still BDOing technically?
No, she's PDC now. She's over on PDC.
Again, that's where the dollar is. Can't fault anybody following that.
The thing is, some of these people... And I think Sherrick is Milton Keynes based as well, I think, if I remember correctly, or around that way. Maybe I'll have to try and get a bit of an interview if I can. But
that would be awesome. I'll tell you what, if you could get the power on, as I say, it would be awesome to have a word with England's most winningest sports star all time.
What I was getting to is the fact that a lot of these players were, before switching to the PDC, they were playing darts, if you like, as a pub sport.
Mm.
And then they moved to the PDC. They see what Barry Hearn's got to offer. It's not just in the PDC. You can say the same for snooker. And yeah, sure. What happened to pool, was the game of pool as well.
Moscone Cup and all that.
Yeah, Barry Hearn's in with all of that, and boxing. It's all in the same sort of
matchroom sports. It's, I tell you, it's a PR machine, and what the Hearn clan has done, and they're very smart. They know their game inside and out, and whatever one might say, and I'm not necessarily their biggest admirer, but I do raise a glass to their talents, is again, they ally themselves to this talent, and then they find the way to get that character doing their thing and package it in a way that it becomes very, very appealing. And that's a slice of genius. The opportunities that they've made available for so many in, as you say, darts, sport, pool, of course, snooker, it's astronomical, and they are geniuses at what they do.
They're bringing in the sponsorships. They're bringing in new tournaments every year. And
again, they've got their eye on the prize, and they know the bigger picture. They have a global presence, and I salute them for that. I totally do. But again, it's a long conversation because there is a nefarious side to the Hearn's clan. But that's by the by. Neil, great shout. Loving your work. Liking the Dynasty chat. Definitely think this is really two rock solid calls so far. And now we are going across to our data machine, the man, the legend, the very machine, Jason McKenna. Who's your first sporting dynasty for us to consider?
Well, I wanted to examine somebody who could also be machine-like from his machine racing. It is Michael Schumacher, Schumi at Ferrari. Now, I wanted to kind of analyse him because the man is a living dynasty. He's the embodiment of what peak performance is in racing. And he created the modern image of winning Ferrari. You know, the team kind of strive to be at the top now. And I think they kind of lost that before he came to the team. So from 2000 to 2004, he got 5 consecutive drivers' championships, scored 72 Grand Prix wins, and he holds plenty of records, but he's got that one of the most wins of an F1 driver ever. You know, he is the winningest, as you'd say there, Tony. But the ride wasn't easy for him, and I've kind of broken it down into three big reasons why I think he was successful at Ferrari. So starting from the beginning, I think it was the team behind him. So Schumacher himself kind of joined a Ferrari team that was in transition. It hadn't won a championship since 1979, and arguably it was a huge, huge gamble for a 26-year-old at their peak in racing to gamble it on a team that, as I said, they hadn't won it for 30-odd years, a driver's championship. Now, probably one of the most important acquisitions for Ferrari was actually a Frenchman called Jean Todt. And in 1993, he joined from Peugeot. And throughout the 80s and 90s, he'd kind of seen Peugeot have success in racing, but that was in rally driving. It wasn't in F1. Mm. So it was a gamble in itself for Ferrari to bring him on. But I'll call him by like an anglicised version. So Todt arrived at the team, and the team was actually in a civil war within itself. The infighting was absolutely awful. And Todt kind of said that the chassis people were blaming the engine people were blaming the chassis people, and nobody knew why the team was not winning. So Todt went about solving that issue, and one of the main things that he thought would unite the team was a driver for them to kind of all work behind and work to that plan. Sadly, and this is really heartbreaking for me when I was doing the research on this, Senna was their first pick. In 1994, they'd kind of made the approach, and then he died. And obviously that kind of legacy there, which could have been absolutely amazing. Ferrari at, you know, Maranello, it would have been absolutely amazing to see him possibly bring it into the new era. But instead, 1995 emerged, two-time world champion Michael Schumacher. And Todt knew from like seeing him in 1995 that he was the man to do it.
From Benetton, didn't he, from memory?
Yes, so he came from Benetton, and his actual acquisition by Benetton is a little bit of a shady one as well. Kind of, there was agreements with Eddie Jordan, Jordan F1 and Jaguar that he should have gone there, but Benetton managed to snap him up. Flavio Briatore brought him to that team. But what was interesting was that there was genius behind the scenes because of Schumacher as well. So in 1996 and 97 as well, Schumacher made sure that key personnel were brought to the team. And this included Ross Brawn, but also they actually convinced Rory Byrne, who was a really, really key kind of F1 car designer. He'd been at Benetton, but he'd retired. And they said, look, we're going to do this project. And Schumacher, Todt and Brawn all kind of got this man to come out for retirement. And my goodness, what a machine he created. He was there until 2006. And the machines that he was making were so, so good. But again, going back to Todt, he had overseen the kind of team. And he'd seen the fact that politics were getting in the way. Prost's car in 1990, so Todt wasn't there then, had all sorts of brilliant aspects to it, but the team kind of couldn't get behind it because of the politics. So Todt as well kind of created this amazing bubble of protection for all the workers so that there was no criticism in between them, but also so that they could work in safety. So Luca de Montezello, he was the Ferrari president at the time, and he said that Schumacher arrived at the right time, which is something that is probably factually correct. But I would say that that kind of detracts from Schumacher to the true extent of how he actually populated the backroom staff as well at Ferrari. So that's my first point. And I think that, yes, Ferrari were fantastic in kind of arranging that. Todt did such a good job to get the right people there. But Schumacher himself was so instrumental in making sure that the backroom staff as well kind of worked together, because he knew them and he handpicked them as well. The second point is obviously Schumacher himself was incredibly talented, ridiculously so. 1994, some people said that was a lucky win. But 95, he proved everybody that he was the two-time world champion for a damn good reason. From a young age, 91 and 92, he impressed the F1 world. But then his kind of aggressive, fearless driving style, which I'll get on to being a little bit controversial as well, it put him up there at the top. And I think as well, from a psychology perspective, which we'll get kind of Graham's input on, but the psychology of his drive was to be bigger and better than everybody else. And he scared competitors as well. So I think that was one of the big things. And finally, Schumacher, amazing, amazing in the wet. 17 out of his 30 races in wet conditions, he won. But also, he got the nickname of Rain King or Rain Master, obviously in German, but I can't really pronounce German too well. And his pinnacle in the rain was undoubtedly the 1996 Spanish Grand Prix, where he lapped the entire field up to third place in the wet, 5 seconds faster than everybody else. It was ridiculous. Lap 19, he was just there from the top. My final point is that Schumacher was a leader. And a lot of people kind of said that Schumacher was more than just a race driver. He was also like a mini team principal. And this is something, again, that Flavio Briatore kind of backs up. He was always at the factory. He was always pushing for perfection. He'd go out there and do extra sessions to test the car out. There's a really good story that in the 90s, the team had kind of put out this upgrade to the car just before the Monaco Grand Prix. And Schumacher wasn't happy. So instead of going, I don't like this, he goes, I don't like this. I'm going to take it all the way back to Ferrari in Italy. Mm-hmm. He flew from Monaco to Italy, tested it, made sure that it was right, and then flew all the way back for qualifying in Monaco. Just sensational stuff.
I love that commitment. I think that's astonishing.
Yeah, it's ridiculously so. But what people also attest to the fact, and this was why he was a true, true leader, he was a model of perfection, but he was also kind, loving, and really involved everybody in his team. He was always talking to mechanics, improving the car, but he was also checking to see if the mechanics were genuinely all right. He seriously cared for people. He'd ask them their family names. He'd make sure that he knew their birthdays, everything. He'd get them gifts. He would literally look after those team members. And when he won, he would always make sure that they were included. He'd always say it to his team. And Ross Brawn kind of really summarizes this nicely with 4 points that he says that Michael was an embodiment of everything good about being a sportsman. He lived by example. Yeah. His fitness regime was incredible. Schumacher also made sure that he never criticized the team in public and showed a real good unity. If there was a problem, of course, he'd say it behind closed doors, but he never did it in public. And one of the big ones was obviously 1999 with the brake failure. He never blamed the team, even though it was a team problem. Number 3 was the humility of Michael and the fact that he showed real care for the team members. And number 4 is kind of like an extension of that, that he'd go out of his way to make sure that people were kind of involved. So he was an amazing person, and I wouldn't be doing it justice, though, if I didn't explain his controversial side. You know, 1997...
I'm thinking Villeneuve and Mr. Hill as well.
Yes, so you've got it there. 97, Villeneuve, he pushes him off the track. 2001 to 2002, there was the kind of controversial use of Barrichello to get to the head of the track and then make way for Schumacher, which Schumacher actually, to be fair, said that he was never on board with. 2006 Monaco Grand Prix is the famous, and I find it quite funny, the parking incident where he crashed the car just so that everybody else couldn't qualify. But, you know, does that devalue from him? That's something that maybe we can discuss here. But I think Schumacher himself is just a living legend. And I think that he goes beyond just being a driver. He's so, so much more than that.
He seems to me like a visionary, Jason, the way you beautifully deconstructed that, who had a total vision of where he was at both personally, and then he understood the nature of this fascinating world of F1, where it is driver and team fusing, and to get every component bit working like a slick, well-oiled machine is phenomenal. And that, again, is a testimony not only to a man's gift, but his will and his vision and how it all fits together. Just astonishing. And again, sometimes I draw breath and I come back to the brute facts. And taking into account, I know this was Dynasty Ferrari, but those two previous F1 wins with Benetton means that Mr. Schumacher remains. I know our man, Stevenage's own Lewis Hamilton, is hunting down on 6 F1 titles. But at the moment, at this present time, winningest, Schumacher, 7 F1 titles. You think of all the greats who've graced the F1 arena throughout the years, who is placed atop the number one until somebody says otherwise? Michael Schumacher. I tell you what, again, similar to what I was discussing with Graham vis-a-vis Fergie time, is what you were talking about, which cannot be taken out of the equation, this aggressive style, this sometimes controversial aspects. But again, winners win. They will do what is required to get the result, not only for them, but for the team too. And I think that's just one component piece, which is a common denominator, maybe indeed the very trademark of all true great sporting champions, of which Michael Schumacher eminently is. Graham, I want to come to you here very briefly, because I think Jason's deconstructed this. I think it's opened up so many options, and we could talk about it forever and a day. But quickly, your learned opinion on the psychology of the Schumacher success story.
Yes, and brilliant work there, Jace. I really like listening to what you were talking about. And a couple of things from me that I want to pick up that you mentioned. And this is about for all of us in life, isn't it? And you talked there about his characteristics and personality of being kind. And how many times in sport or business do we see nasty people being nasty to other people, right? And these people who have that I'm going to say mindset, although I don't really like that word, but mindset. People who think being nasty in the workplace or in a sports organisation is okay, it's not. And Schumacher proved that. And the second thing is, why don't teams operate in business or in sports organisations? Why don't they operate, which is something you picked up on? It's because there's too much selfishness from individuals, right? And we see that even right up into our own lives in business. And that selfishness is not okay. It is not okay for people to think it's all about them, and what they want to get is their aim or their goal within that environment, be it our work or their work. So the whole team dynamic of it is people have to be more selfless, and he was that. And people have to be more thoughtful and caring to include people, so inclusivity. Mm-hmm. And accept diversity amongst us, you know, by being human. He was this. And there's loads of other characteristics in sports, people that have the exact same thing. And that is leadership. And people try and overcomplicate this word leadership. And I listen to a lot of people trying to make some good money out of overcomplicating these things. But it's not. It's simple stuff. It's about being human, connected, be kind, which we're all taught as kids when we're growing up. But then we seem to lose track because we then have to put our shields up because of this nastiness. And I think he made such a huge success because he was himself. He wasn't trying to be anybody else. And therefore, people looked up to that, and it gave people a sense of relief to think, oh my God, this is good. I can say what I really think rather than actually trying not to say what I think. So he nailed it, like many other sports people, to get to that pinnacle. And actually, we've all got it in within us. It's about being brave. Can we actually go and execute that? And I think he did that really, really well.
Gigi, I love that analysis. I really, really do. And you're a man who lives this, the art of leadership, that humility, that setting one's own ego aside, which clearly, as Jason really brilliantly explained, was one of the emblems of the success story that is Michael Schumacher. And we do, of course, send our thoughts and best wishes to family Schumacher. No time to go into it at this time, but he remains always one of the greatest sports stars all time, certainly representative in that era of sheer dominance with Ferrari, every inch a dynasty. Great shout. However, just quickly, and I want your views on this because I know you've got many. Fascinating, isn't it, to have this compare and contrast? Neil wonderfully introduced us to the psychology and the arrogancy, you could say, of the winningest English sportsman of all time in Dynasty Phil Taylor. Compare and contrast that, worlds apart, it would seem, with the team ethos visionary of Michael Schumacher. And I found this myself in my time interviewing an eclectic array of sports stars, ranging from Olympic stars like Sally Gunnell through to Mavericks and World Cup winners like David Campese. I very rarely find an athlete who doesn't fit into one or other of those poles, either living a very ego-focused world, which, by all fairness, they embody and they justify by their success, thinking, for instance, a Campese, versus that humility, that calm, that appreciation, exemplified perhaps in Schumacher. And again, I've experienced it in, just off the top of my head, for instance, Sally Gunnell, one of the only women in the elite club of five GB athletes all time to get that clean sweep in all world meets, Olympic, world, European and Commonwealth Games. So I find it fascinating that it does seem to be this yin-yang psychology, extremer types almost, that reflect the attitude to life of great sports stars. Tell you what, I know you've got opinions on these. Are our best sports stars humble or really giving, or do they tend to have that arrogancy, that complete sheer and utter conviction in their own greatness, and then they achieve that, almost manifest it? Love your opinions. I found that a very interesting component of my experiences here on Verulam Sport, but I know you've got opinions. Get involved. Remember, always, this is your show, every bit as much as it is ours. So tweet at Verulam Sport and keep those opinions flowing. Keep the machine busy. Hey, talking machine, quickly before I introduce my first sporting dynasty, I want to go back to Jason. Awesome Schumacher analysis as standard with yourself, machine. We've come to grow accustomed to your wonderful analysis. Quickly, because we must power forward, your quick off-the-cuff appraisal on this weird kind of dichotomy of psychology when it comes to sporting exceptions and exceptional performances. On the one extrema, humility and giving and team spirit. On the other, sheer bloody-minded, one-eyed focus, and which could well often be construed as arrogancy. Your thoughts, just quickly.
Well, I think the best people in sport are normally arrogant or at least self-confident in a sense. You know, they have to believe in their abilities so much so that they're willing to risk life and limb sometimes. But I think the kind of arrogance with the fans is something that I don't personally think you can forgive, because in many senses, the fans are the only reason why you're there. Mm. You know, if footballers are rude and arrogant towards their fans, then they're kind of forgetting the fact that if these thousands upon thousands of people watching and turning up didn't, then they wouldn't have their amazing salary. So I think you can be arrogant maybe with those around you to show your skills, but humility in that kind of huge kind of grandeur of being one of the best around, I think, is one of the most endearing kind of things to me as well. Because as Graham has kind of really you know, talked about previously, and I have with Schumacher, you are part of a team. You know, even if you're an individual, you still have a dietitian or all these elements. And I just can't escape the fact that you need to kind of respect those people as well. Because, yes, they might not be paid as much. They might be not there on the track or something. But if you forget those that have pushed you up, then, you know, you've kind of forgotten yourself as well.
Love that point. And I'll tell you what, I love being surrounded by such a skilled and able and smart and humble team as Verulam Sport Podcasting is lucky to possess. I'm sure out there you appreciate our efforts too, and always love to hear from you. Anything sporting dynasties, tweet at Verulam Sport. Sports on the Premier League, of course, it carries on. We'll end tonight with a bit of a prediction through Neil Stock. No, you're excited for the return of the Premier League. It has been weird, I think. No fans, we knew that was the case, but your views, keep them coming. And indeed, anything sports related, tweet at Verulam Sport. Keep the machine busy. But now it's my turn to enter into the dynasty arena. And it was actually mentioned in the social media world right at the start of today's conversation. They are marred in controversy now, but I'm setting them in a bubble and setting aside their achievements. And it is Saracens under Mark McCall, 2011 through to present day. He took over from Brendan Venter, great South African, a very outspoken man. And he is, by contrast, so calmly spoken. He very rarely flouts himself in the media, even through this turbulent time, just almost sticks in the shadows. He is worlds apart from, for instance, Don Sir Alex Ferguson, who again we've discussed tonight, just a supremely cerebral rugby mind who understands how to surround himself with phenomenal coaches as well. Again, a man who understands culture and the mode towards success. And the success is, and I grant you the controversy, we will no doubt discuss it, but I'm banging it into a little bubble because I honestly think if you just look at what's been achieved under McCall since 2011, he's got Saracens 5 English Premiership Championships, 3 European Cups, and 2 of those were back to back. What a decade of success it has been for the previously unfancied journeyman of Saracens. And it's not just Mark McCall, but it's his overall awareness of the culture that he tries to instill. Famously, they were referred to as the Wolf Pack, and that reflected a very intense style of defense, really. But it really does apply. They hunt as a team. They live and breathe as a team. And that is why they have gone on to such a litany of success, phenomenal efforts. And I tell you what, I was very, very fortunate indeed to be up at St. James's Park for Verum Sports, for the final of the European Cup last year, in which they came from behind against defending champions Leinster, who Leinster had knocked Saracens out at the semi-final stage in the previous tournament. And what is the emblem of any great sporting institution isn't necessarily success, but the lessons learnt in defeat. Now, I was at the press conference of that semi-final. There were no excuses. There were none. There was just a sheer recognition. On that very day, Leinster were superior. And I think that was just a very fair appraisal. But there was an awful lot of, at that moment, almost goal setting. We've got next year. We'll be back. Leinster, we'll be gunning for you. Don't you worry. There was no worries. There was no tears. There was no complaints. It was very phlegmatic, very honest. And I was very struck by that. And then you whip it forward a year and they're in the final again, this time against those foes who beat them in that semi-final, Leinster. And I tell you what, you might recall, I am going into half-time in the last 5 minutes of that. It was looking like a one-way street, not a positive one from a Sarri's perspective. They were 10-0 down. And then the wonderful Farrell, who is such a star, kicked a penalty. And then that just seemed to galvanize them. They found that spark. And then they got a wonderful try scored by Williams, who's now left the club, over in the corner, right at the death. And that was converted brilliantly by Farrell, who was the tournament's top scorer. And it just seemed to galvanise them. That second half, there was only ever going to be one winner. They just turned the corner, rode that momentum. And for me, those two moments reflect everything that Mark McCall has instilled. Again, the honesty in defeat, the lessons learned, and then that refusal to go in at halftime down, 10-0 down in a rugby context. That's almost, to put it into a football parlance, like being borderline 3-0 down, certainly 2 goals down, going into the halftime. And often that's a mountain, but they made it 10-all. In fact, they actually took the lead with a penalty converted going into the half. And that second half, they were worlds apart. They were so class, so dominant. Now, often Saracens are criticised for a slightly dour brand of rugby, but that is just to do them no service whatsoever. Again, I set them apart from the critiques, but I would argue, and I'm on the record of this, for reasons that are wide and varied, Saracens have always been the sort of late the party team. There's always been a lot of anti-Saracens feelings amongst the usual rugby establishment. And that rugby establishment wanted to tarnish Saracens as a boring, dour, forward-orientated team. But it forgets the fact that they were actually the top try scorers in last year's European Cup. The likes of Farrell pulls the strings. But ultimately, McCall, coming from Ulster, retired from the game of rugby after 13 caps from Ireland, very young, only 31, for a prolapsed disc in his back. But he's taken all this knowledge, surrounds himself with brilliant rugby men and rugby minds. He and Borthwick, who now Borthwick coaches at the England level, really instilled that Wolfpack mentality and has led to a dynasty of success. Again, five England championships in the Premiership, three European Cups. We were talking, weren't we, Ferguson, maybe the blip, the blemish on his overall record. Excuse me. It's only two European titles in a 27-year career. Well, McCall has three European titles. That's only one away from winningest, that word again, which is held by jointly for Leinster, Toulouse and Toulon. But he's the only English team in European Cup rugby with three European titles. It speaks volumes. The success, the culture, it's wonderful. The trophy cabinet is glistening and it's absolutely sublime. It's not a one-man show, but Mark McCall has been the director of it, the instiller, the Don, if you would, but a very softly spoken, quietly authoritative man. And I tell you, Jamie George, England and British Lions international, Saracen style. He's moving on, I think, next season. Great player, though. He made a great quote. I think this is brilliant. Speaking of Mark McCall, he said he's very clever as well in terms of the messages he gives to the group. The group, I think, is a key word there. And his and he is loved. There's that word again that Jason highlighted in terms of Schumacher and the team ethos. And he's loved by every single person in the squad. Speaks volumes there. Jamie George's words, and I tell you, we'll no doubt debate the nefarious side of things, and I won't dispute them, I won't deny them. But again, I just put it in a bubble. Mark McCall is a genius, and from a rugby culture perspective, it's phenomenal. In terms of dynasties, in terms of trophies in the cabinet, in a relative short span of time, they stack up, they can hold their head high and look any dynasty in the eyes. Saracens, Wolfpack, Mark McCall's vision, great team, true sporting dynasty. But I'm no doubt, fellas, you want to have a chime in with one or two points on this. So I'll open it up to one and indeed all.
Well, I think you've kind of alluded to it there, Tony. And for me with Saracens, you know, I'm not the biggest of rugby fans, but from an outside perspective, and from reading about their conduct as well, they kind of didn't help themselves with not actually working with the kind of rugby authorities. I think part of the kind of double down on actually making sure that they got relegated was the fact that they didn't actually help with the investigation. And to be fair, I would be quite annoyed as a neutral rugby fan for that. But I would just look at dynasties like Juventus or Lance Armstrong, and I would say, you know, Lance Armstrong, fantastic cyclist, but can you count him as one of the all-time greats? Can you count his dynasty with the fact that it's been rescinded due to what he did? Juventus as well, that was obviously out-and-out kind of bribing officials, but still breaking the rules for me. If you're breaking rules, and I know you'll probably come back and say that it's an unfair kind of punishment, maybe over the top, but rules are rules. It's that they're there, that they shouldn't be broken. And what Saracens did, underhand overpaying people by 1.1 million and then 900,000 another season, yeah, it just can't be forgiven. And for me, it just detracts from a dynasty. You know, it's a dynasty based on lies, on cheating. And it might be, you know, devaluing, obviously, the amazing management of McCall. You know, as an individual manager, I can't take that away. But if he's got there by illegitimate means, which maybe he didn't delve in at all himself, I can't see it myself. I don't know what you think, though, Graham. Is that kind of too...
Yeah.
Too... I don't know, detracting from the success.
I see your point there, Jace. And you know, with top elite sport, which that exactly is, you're looking for ingredients. It's really about little small ingredients that make the cake, right? So if you take one of them two ingredients and you get an advantage, if that's not organic, then you've got to ask the question, well, you know, did that one piece of ingredient help them achieve what they achieved? And we don't know that. We'll never know that, will we? Because we now know what we know. And I think I always remember Exeter in that situation, because I actually think what Exeter did and the size of Exeter and where they got to just miss out because of Saracens being still phenomenal. And rightly what Tony points out about McCall is incredible. And his background, it just shows with the disappointment and the mental health that he had to go through to pull himself back from his playing career to take something and actually pull people together and use his experience positively. You know, maybe we're doing him a disservice because he's done a lot of great things, but that one ingredient, it doesn't taste very well, does it? It sticks in your throat as, okay, well, they've had a slight advantage. And I went down to watch Saracens a couple of years ago. It was fantastic, you know, down at the Allianz Arena. And it was just brilliant how that's turned around, you know, from a point of view of an athletics track into turning it into a local rugby club. But, you know, one of the Europe's big rugby club because of what's going on down there. And seeing their squad and everything, I thought, blimey, we've got some brilliant internationals playing here.
And I'm thinking, you both make wonderful, wonderful points. Okay, first things first, before I kind of come back on this matter, I want to just touch on what you've alluded to there, Graham, brilliantly. One of the emblems of this Wolfpack attitude, though, and one of the things Mark McCall quietly is very keen, much the same way we were talking about, for instance, under Watford and Graham Taylor, that they would be very open and they've got this great community ethos that we love to hear about, even to this day when we chat with Richard Walker. But they have the same kind of attitude. You see Jamie George being pictured, you know, literally even in the last couple of weeks with street vendors. And they are very much open. They're out there amongst the people, kind of just engaging. And, you know, it's not just a PR stunt. They genuinely love representing Saracens and representing Hertfordshire area. And they get out and they do great things in conjunction with, for instance, our friends over at Old Albanians, where they share training facilities. They are a very warm, family-orientated club. And I think that is, in this era of hyper-professionalism, ultra-rare. And again, it's to their credit. Now, coming back to the question in question, really, is have they taken or did they take advantage of the hyper-professionalism and did that give them unfair advantages? Okay. Now, first and foremost, they have been found guilty. So there's no questions about it. Jason, you were really on the money with the statistical facts around that. The salary cap is $7 million and in each of the last three seasons. So you consider the dynasty before that. It was well underway. But in each of the last three seasons, essentially, they've been found to be $1.9 million in excess of that, right? Now, again, first of all, I'll come back and say this. You've made a wonderful point with regards to Exeter. And of course, Exeter and other neutrals around the rugby world would be kind of, you know, huffing and puffing and getting really kind of angsty about it. I get that point of view. But only Exeter have the amount of homegrown talent that Saracens have boasted throughout this dynasty. Now, they're losing so many of those players to England and World Cup situations, but the next generation is still being bred, and it would be easy for them to go out and invest in international stars, and they bolster the team with international stars. They've got a World Cup winner in their front row, for instance. Williams, who scored that try to get them back into last year's final, was, you know, he's a Welsh international, right? He's now left. But my point is that what they do in terms of cultivating local talent is right up there. Only really Exeter can hold a candle to them, right? Now, going back a few seasons, one of the things that when they originally kind of got under the radar and kind of a few warning signs were triggered was because it looked as though they had been kind of infringing upon this back then. But actually, it was mitigated by the fact that some of their salary cap had to take account for the fact it was up to a 60% allowance for if you are losing a chunk of your players, as Saracens always will, to these England times, if that makes sense. So with that 60% factor, it transpired that they were actually well within the salary cap kind of constraints. But I guess that signaled a little bit of a warning sign. Now, what they actually did wasn't overplay players, okay? And again, I get that there are loopholes, etc., etc. But 100%, I think this is unique and different to Jason. For instance, cyclist Lance Armstrong, because of course that was drug driven, totally inorganic cheating par excellence, whichever way you look at it, inexcusable, right? And of course his titles, his seven, have been retracted out of the history books. I get that, and I think that's only right and proper. But here, what Saracens actually were doing, Nigel Ray, was basically kind of giving kind of options for players to invest. And then he would be a co-investor. That might be in properties. That might be in, there is sort of a brewery that I think certain other players had. Now, rugby is a well-paid sport, particularly at this level, but it pales into insignificance compared to the likes of F1, the likes of Premier League football, for instance. And, of course, it is a very finite sport. Each and every single day in training, you're putting your life, your career on the line. It could be one poorly timed tackle, game over. So really, as a chairman, what Ray was achieving or trying to cultivate, as well as this culture of success, was a culture of opportunity for his players and his squad to optimize his career, which I think is creditable. Now, Jason, you were dead right to observe the thing where it gets really nefarious and where I don't really have a defense is that when this did come to light, Saracens did have a choice of opening their books and being totally transparent or kind of just taking on the chin, taking the hit and going like, we'll rebuild, right? And it is, I must confess, highly suggestive that they chose the latter, not the former. But ultimately, my kind of defense for them is that the timescale through which this transparency needed to be given was very, very rushed through. And again, I'm not saying that's a defense, but I'm saying that in like bare logistical terms, their options were fairly limited. Okay. Now, that for all of those reasons, for me, means that yes, it is a loophole, but ultimately, this is a very homegrown, organic, from the grassroots up developed club whereby their chairman, maybe he should have been smarter about this, probably should have been better advised, should have been more transparent, but if anything, was guilty of only providing wider post-career options for his squad. And therefore, I think Mark McCall was not a privy to this. I think the playing culture doesn't stand alone, irrespective of that. And therefore, for my money, they are still worth every trophy they've earned, and the dynasty stands. But of course, that's my two pennies. It is a convoluted one. I'm not a lawyer or anything of that nature. But I'm going to whip it across Neil, who I'm sure has been listening intently. Quickly, your thoughts. Has this recent emergency of Saracens loophole finding of laws and subsequently being found guilty of infringing an imposed and indeed known salary cap, does that tarnish their dynasty?
Well, I don't know a great deal about rugby, to be honest. I do like watching it, but I don't know the ins and outs of it. However, even when you look at football, they're bringing salary caps in and things like that. Manchester City, I think they're on a salary cap. And it's happening in all sports. But can you, going back to the question, can you take the dynasty away? I don't think so, because the players themselves generally are not privy to what's going on in the boardroom. They just play for their money and play for the team. It's a difficult one, really.
Yeah, it is. But as I say, for me, their bubble, their achievement, their trophies stand, and therefore they are a dynasty in my head. But that's my view only. It is not. Nobody died and made me lord and overseer of who and what is a sporting dynasty and what fair and foul is in this murky modern world that we live in. But I tell you what, I know you've got views on this. Some of you, no doubt, will be well on side with my perspective and think to themselves, Saracens have been harshly treated. And indeed, there has been something of a witch hunt. If that's your perspective, I'd love you to get involved. Tweet at Verulam Sport, or of the mindset of our very pure-minded Jason McKenna, and also echoed by Graham Griffin, who basically looks at it and says, well, look, whatever way you look at it, there was rules that were applied, everybody knows about them, and they've been proven to have infringed and been guilty of, on some kind of level, nefariously finding perhaps an unfair inch or one percenter. What's your views? Come on, views on Saris. Get them in. Tweet at Verulam Sport. Thoughts across all things Dynasty and indeed, of course, Premier League or anything sporting related. This is your show every bit as much as it is ours. So tweet at Verulam Sport and keep those views coming. We love, honestly, we genuinely love hearing from you. And right now, I love always hearing back from the voice of the Saints, Graham Griffin. Graham, who's your second sporting dynasty to be considered?
So we're going to keep a rugby theme, Tony, and that's a seamless link. I didn't realise you were going to do that. But so my second and final team dynasty is going to be the wonderful, wait for it, you've guessed it, it is the All Blacks. So the New Zealand men's national team. And the dynasty here, the few key points I want to pick out and then obviously get your thoughts, being a rugby man, Tony, but also Jason and Neil. Key thing for me is how that is their national sport and how that is part of not only just sport and playing rugby, it's part of their psyche, it's part of their DNA.
It's and a everybody, religion. It's a religion in New Zealand.
Yeah, exactly. So they're brought up on rugby first, you know, and I think that's incredible from a physical and from a mental perspective. I think that's fantastic. But if we look at them from a sporting perspective, some stats here, Jess, which I think you'll love. It's something like they've got a 77% win rate. Just checking my notes here. That's right, yeah, 77% winning record in Test match rugby. That is phenomenal. And I think they've it's something along the lines with all the 19 nations that they've played. They've 12 of them have never won against the All Blacks. Now we saw the last year or two where the Irish were coming good under Joe Smith, right? And they had that win in Chicago a few years back, and it was quite a historic win for the Irish. And then obviously they beat them again, didn't they? And then one of the winter series. And you're thinking, Ireland are going to do brilliant in the World Cup. And then what happens? Obviously, the Kiwis, you're thinking, well, they're going to do something again because they won the first one in 1987. They won in 2011 and 2015. And even when their players are retiring, you think, oh, that player's fantastic. The likes of Dan Carter, you think, how are they going to survive? But somebody else comes out of nowhere and you're thinking, it's just like a conveyor belt of mentality and a conveyor belt of sort of DNA that I really feel that's got to be an all-time dynasty for a sporting team stroke nation. And the other thing is, you know, you look at Richie McCall, he's got the most caps, hasn't he, 148. So you look at how they're all role models for each other. And isn't it wonderful just watching the Haka? It's just one of my favourite moments in sport.
You know, I love a bit of sporting theatre. And I actually have a bit of a discussion with my dad about this. He's very anti the Haka. And I'm like, Dad, this is great. This is just warfare. This is what it's all about. And I loved it. It was years ago now. England did it brilliantly in the World Cup, incidentally. But I loved it years ago when Leicester Tigers' own Richard Cockerell went up to the great hooker, never quite made it to the highest level. He was in the New Zealand team at the time. Guy couldn't storm in Norman Hewitt and literally eyeballed him. But again, that's brilliant. It's that kind of tribal quality that is. It gets the hairs on the back of your neck rising. You've got to love a Haka.
And I hope we don't lose that because some people see that as intimidation, but I see that as they're just demonstrating their culture and their background. And I actually love the way that teams are responding now, as you refer to. I thought the England team were phenomenal when obviously they sort of, in return, intimidated back, if we do see it as intimidation. I just think it's very healthy.
It's picking that gauntlet up, isn't it? I tell you what, it's brilliant.
It's just healthy, competitive focusing on what's about to happen and trying to beat your opponent fairly and squarely. And I think obviously rugby does that really, really well. So from a perspective of an all-time great, from a sporting team, from a cultural team, from a DNA, I think the All Blacks are absolutely phenomenal. But I'd love your thoughts.
I'm so chuffed you brought them to the table. And you know what? Obviously, it does pay me because that record is obviously phenomenal. It's a phenomenal record against England. I think England's record is, reasonably shocking. But everybody's is. There's just a 77% win record. And as you say, you know, you go for Richie McCaw, but before that there was Crook. And before that, just so many others. And the greats of the game, Kerwin, Jonah Lomu, Fitzpatrick. And before that, the likes of, Brian Lahore. And these names, they're enshrined in rugby folklore. And they just have that DNA. As you say, it is their culture. It is their thing. In much the same way as, for instance, great shout by one of our listeners earlier on when he was talking about the Brazilian team in football, 50s through to 70s. I think at the international level, and let's be honest, international level is really where you separate the men from the boys, don't you? And at international level, the highest of the high, really, I think the only team across all sports that can say, yeah, you know what, we can have a chat, mano a mano, different sports entirely, but would be that Brazilian era, right? Tell you what, coming back to their culture, and it is their blood, it is their DNA, it is the way they do it. One thing they do, which I think is really clever, and I think it's worth considering, okay, you look at Jonah Lomu, and he changed the game of rugby. I would argue, it's a long conversation, but I would argue actually his force and his force into the mainstream forced rugby to go professional. People forget, rugby union's only been professional since that 95 World Cup. By the way, 95 World Cup, I know we're talking All Blacks. It was 25 years to the day when South Africa, opened up the Rainbow Nation with Mandela and obviously Pienaar holding aloft, beating New Zealand in the final, where Lomu's New Zealand were heavily favoured. And again, that memory for me lives strong. And I just think, I don't want to open Pandora's box, we'll bring it back to the All Blacks, but I just think at this moment, we all need to be aware of the importance of cultural heritage and of equality. Rugby promotes those ethos. And 25 years ago, what a great victory that was. But coming back to Lomu, he forced the game to be professional. But what New Zealand do, massively different to how we organise things at a young age group, where you basically are under 18s, under 17s, under 16s. Man, you could be 13 and be one of those guys who's developed earlier. And you're not really learning about rugby because you're just scoring every time you get the ball by dint of being the biggest chappy on the pitch, right? Whereas in New Zealand, what they do is they do it by weight, right? So if you're one of those youngsters like Lomu, who developed early, at the age of 15, he was playing with 19, 20-year-olds, okay? Now, that meant that, yeah, they were going to be stopping him sometimes, but his natural ability was being challenged and pushed forwards. Whereas here, like I say, some people get a false sense of their own quality just by dint of being one of life's early developers. And you see it all the time. They throw him the ball, and it's not doing the rest of the team any good either, because the whole attitude is give it to Big Jimmy, it will score. Great. But it's not great, really, because eventually there comes a time where everybody kind of vaguely equalizes, and all of a sudden, Big Jimmy's not challenging himself, and he kind of stagnates, if that makes sense. So I think that approach from a young age to equalizing and to developing talent and through challenging talent based not on age, but on, as they use it down there, KG, right, kilograms, means that, again, health and safety must always be to the fore, no question. But I just think it's a smarter, more challenging, I think arguably fairer, and I think ultimately reflects this great dynasty that they've built at the highest level. And I think we here in the Northern Hemisphere could learn a thing or two from it. Could talk about New Zealand's culture and heritage and rugby forever and a day. You mentioned Dan Carter, of course. We love a good stat. He is rugby union's all-time highest point scorer. What a legend he is, and just one of the all-time greats. So many great players throughout that country's rugby culture and heritage. Great shout. Quickly coming across to Jason for your thoughts, briefly.
Yeah, I mean, undoubtedly so. The New Zealand team, it's that culture. Again, as somebody who's kind of outside of the rugby fold, I just found it so interesting and so forward-thinking with that idea of actually on KG rather than, you know, quality in kind of age groups and stuff. And, you know, moving on to my dynasty that I will discuss a little bit later, the person that I will talk about does the same sort of thing, but with football. So, you know, teasing it up a little bit there, that's going to be an exciting one. But we do have to hear from Neil as well in terms of dynasties.
Yeah, Neil, just quickly, your final thoughts here, wrapping this up before we move it on. And Jason, I tell you what, you love a good teaser. Great work. And yeah, Neil, just quickly, finally, wrapping up your thoughts on New Zealand rugby-wise.
To be honest, I think they are they are the best at rugby, and they do set themselves up really, really well. And no matter what happens, they've always got a good player coming through. They've got a good bench. They've got a good excellent quality in all positions on the pitch, and they are just hard to break down. But they're set up in such a way that makes them difficult to be broken down, if you like, and hard to play against.
What it is, I think, beautifully, and final up in summation here, we talk about culture and they live the culture, but it's a beautiful kind of perfect storm where grassroots feeds superstars who in turn inspire grassroots. And you've got this constant synergy and cycle whereby the next generation is already there in place, already primed, ready to move things forwards. Great shout, Graham. Loving that.